nice to see you all. Thank you all for coming. I have the great pleasure and honor to introduce Professor Elaine Theron today. That's not her first time in Uvascular, it's her fourth time, I believe.
Third time.
Earlier she followed Kari Sayavar's invitation and went to Iowa in Uvascular, so this is not totally new to her, but it's really great that she keeps coming back and says something. We didn't scare you off. Elaine is a professor emerita of the University of Minnesota. She served as the director of CARLA, the Center for Advanced Research on Language Acquisition, in 1993, and then again for 20 years between 1996 and 2016. And so her name is inseparably linked to learner language and social context and interlanguage and interlanguage phonology, language play, second language oracy, and of course language teacher education, and specifically the International Language Teacher Education Conference. She was the editor of Applied Linguistics from 1984 to 1989, and the president of AAAL in 1991-1992. An organization that I think is really important in our field, and also awarded her with the very prestigious Distinguished Scholarship and Service Award in 2012, which was then followed in 2016 by the TESOL 50 at 50 Award. That's an award that you get if you do a lot of good things for a long time. So it's not enough to do a little bit or a lot of good things for once, but you have to really be persistent and impactful. And most recently, she has published as a member of the Dutch Spur Group, which we'll hear about today. So this was the official part. Did I do it okay?
Yeah.
Okay. A few more personal words, if I'm allowed. When I was a student at the University of Minnesota, Elaine was Carla. And I think at some point we probably all called you that. Carla, the Center for Advanced Research on Language Acquisition. Studying second language education at the university that had a Carla meant that we were constantly reminded of the impact our work has and has to have on research as researchers and language teachers and educators. Maybe it's comparable to a daycare with a really great playground where children learn so much more and so much more deeply because they're always engaged and exposed to the practice and reality of research, language education, and language teacher education. And we owe this to Carla, so to Elaine. And so these names being so connected and getting confused is actually a huge compliment. So fine if they start calling you Solki. That's a good thing. In Austria, we have a word for people who bend over in front of their superiors and kick the ones that are below them. We call them bikers. And Elaine would be the opposite, so I couldn't come up with a sport, but it would be something like upside down biking. It sounds dangerous. So she would be someone who reaches down to lift somebody up and kicks the ones on top a little bit, although her kicking is maybe less kicking, but her reaching up would maybe always manifest itself. I remember when we tried to make an argument that was somehow making sense, or submitted a paper that was not totally off, she would say the famous sentence, "I think you're onto something." And that is a really good sentence to say because it made us inquire more and get more curious, encourage us to keep asking and keep arguing and keep exploring. And her way of, that was, I think, her way of making herself small so we could have space to grow. And her way of kicking was, I wouldn't say it was a brutal or violent way of kicking, but I think her way of kicking is saying "but" a lot. And so I think in many of her publications, I think she's asking the question, "but." So when people talk about language, then she would maybe say, "but what about variation?" And when people started to talk about second languages, she would maybe say, "but what about teaching second languages?" And when people talked about second language teaching, then she would maybe say, "but what about the learners?" And then when people said, "we're finally talking about the learners," she would maybe say, "but what about learners from oral traditions?" And when people, and generally always the question, "but what about social context?" So if you are into language education and you think social context matters, then I think you and Elaine have a lot in common, and you probably owe a lot of the things that happened in our field to Elaine. And I took a class with Elaine that was based on this book. I'll pass it around too. It's very red, as you can see. And one of the main characters of this book is this guy. His name is Rodrigo, or not his real name, but anyway, his name in the book. So you follow six language learners, and as you listen to their speech and you analyze their speech, you kind of learn a lot about second language acquisition. That was the idea. And this picture, it's just one of six, but he was my favorite, so he gets to be here on the slide. So maybe in this type, he would have been the one to consider with the lowest English proficiency. And that's how many of us graduate students saw him at first. But throughout the whole semester, as we analyzed and his and his peers' speech and how it developed, the errors that they made, and what these errors might mean, and how complex language was, and how the learners constructed to negotiate meaning and form, and how they pronounced words, all these things, we kind of got attached. We started to like those people a lot. We kind of fell in love with them a little bit and developed a whole new respect for them. And as we were rooting for them and really getting attached to them, I was starting to think that maybe that's the actual point of this book. And maybe that's the actual point of Elaine's work. That we all get really attached to our language learners. Mm. And when I asked Elaine about her academic achievements on the weekend when she was staying over at my family's place, she said that she was very persistent, and I couldn't agree more. I think Elaine is somebody who has incredible focus, who can gather a huge variety of beings, human, non-human, superhuman, family, almost strangers, elderly and young, alive and material, around the table to focus on something. Or who else here has played chess with humans, adults, children, Spider-Man, a dog, and a dragon. I think that says a lot. Today, Elaine is here to talk about her work in the Douglas Fir Group and beyond. And as I learned, this is not the name of a tree, the Douglas Fir, but the name of a hotel room in Portland. Elaine, please help me, join me in welcoming Elaine Theron.
So you should go to Mikkeli, and you will have wonderful hospitality from everyone in Hannah's family. You could sit here. We just moved you. I'm sorry. I had a wonderful, wonderful weekend with my husband, who's taking photographs. So show him your good side. Yeah. I first came to Finland in 1979. There was an event in Helsinki, and all I remember of it really is the fact that we all were taken to Turku at a certain point to a sauna, and were initiated into the joys of sauna, and I remember jumping into a very cold ocean along with colleagues, including Evelyn Hatch. Any of you know who Evelyn Hatch is? My enduring remembrance of Evelyn Hatch was an older scholar, a woman from UCLA, who wrote the first book on discourse analysis and second language acquisition. Actually, she had her students research in that book. Evelyn was bouncing around in the dark going, woohoo, woohoo, woohoo. It just changes your whole picture of a person to experience nature that way. Okay. Well, Hannah asked me to talk about the Douglas Fir Group, and I will do that. And what I thought that I would do is give you some background to the establishment of the Douglas Fir Group, and it'll be autobiographical of necessity, I think. I decided to take that approach, and I'm sorry, but that I suppose it's a privilege you get when you retire as you start thinking about your life, and you are asked to do this, and you go, when did I start thinking about this? And immediately you go back. But I actually was in I just want to finish this, but being in Helsinki then I came for one of the summer schools. Kari Sayavara invited a number of us to come and do a summer institute on second language acquisition. I team taught that course in 1992 with Larry Selinker and Sue Gass. And our memory of that is going through all of our lesson plans in one session, because none of the students would participate in interaction or answer our questions. So we were forced to answer them ourselves and go into, oh, I have to start tomorrow's lecture because I still have half an hour. Okay. And so it was traumatic, and I'm told you will ask questions and you will discuss things, and things have changed, so that makes me happy. And then 1996, of course, we came for Ayla, and again, Kari Sayavara was very important. So when I think of Jyväskylä, I think of Kari Sayavara, and I have a very warm feeling in my heart because he built something really beautiful here, and I can still see it growing. So, oh, good. So the Douglas Fir Group. I mean, basically, my contact in this field started when I took a year off from teaching high school. I had tried to teach in Harlem for 2 summers, and it was my first contact with African American youth and the language they spoke. And I remember very vividly being in the middle of a classroom for high school dropouts and listening to the conversation going on around me and saying, I know they're speaking English, but I do not understand a single word. How can this be? You're like, what are they speaking, right? So when I went back at the end of the summer, instructor at Cal Berkeley, where I'd gotten my degree, said, well, that's called, at that time, it was called Black English, right? So African American vernacular, and there are people who study it. And there are a couple of places you can go, and one of them is Edinburgh University in Scotland is a nice department of applied linguistics. So I went there. They were quite surprised that I was going to Edinburgh to learn how to analyze Black English, but they accepted me. And in the process, I came into contact with Pitt Corder, Larry, and most particularly Larry Selinker. And I'm going to talk about that experience in a minute. But I, as it turned out, because I was there in 1968 to 69, I had stumbled into a kind of revolution in thinking about people who were learning second languages. Up to that point, it had been a behaviorist model. People did contrastive analysis. It was heavily dominated by linguistics and the whole idea that all the errors that learners made in learning a second language as adults could be traced to their first language. And Larry Selinker, like me, is a contrarian. Mm-hmm. You captured it nicely, but my mother always said I was a contrarian. It means if you say A, I say B, or Y, right? So Larry was busily, you know, writing a paper to say, well, really? Is that really how it works? A basic question, I know, because I was there when that paper was written, and I was there when people decided this is a field of study, the study of second language acquisition. A basic question from the beginning was, what are we studying? Is this a cognitive process? Is it just a cognitive process? Or is it also social? So the questions I'm posing here are, I think of our field as a question-asking field, not an answer-giving field as much as a question-asking field. So the question is second language acquisition exclusively in an individual's mind? And so is interlanguage what learners know and can tell you? Is it explicit knowledge, or is it possibly a kind of knowledge that isn't accessible to people do things or act on knowledge, but they can't tell you what that knowledge is? And then how do researchers model this interlanguage system, if there is one? And then the opposite is, well, what about social context? So you have to realize I had just done a dissertation on intonation in African-American vernacular, and I had read William LeBove, I had read all of the sociolinguists. So I came into this applied linguistics program thinking about social context, that I had been convinced that social context is always important. So I came from sociolinguistics, and I have been, I think, faithful to that background for a few decades. So the question is, are things like task or interlocutor or topic, do they influence what learners know or are able to access at any given time? And then how do we model that? So the field is taken to begin with the interlanguage paper, which Larry Selinker published in 1972. It's the same year I got my PhD with him on my committee, and I could tell you over beer about that experience sometime, but I won't now. So in 1968, I spent a year studying applied linguistics. I learned to live without light in the winter. I learned to live with cold all the time. And I learned to go to the pub to get warm and argue with people, right? So Larry Selinker was the only other American there. He was eccentric. He was a visiting Fulbright scholar with a New York accent and what Scots considered rude manners. And he was writing a paper he called Interlanguage. And what I remember is that he was always taking notes on little bits of paper everywhere he went, even the parties. You could find him on the kitchen floor scribbling notes. And in discussion, someone would say something, go, oh, and he'd write what you said, right? And then when that paper got published, it's full of footnotes, right? And the footnotes are, so-and-so disagrees with this point, right? And citing you, right? Like, I remember I disagreed, but I don't remember those words, right? So anyway, everything he gathered went conscientiously into that paper. He was trying to give credit to everybody's ideas. And that is where our field began, with that kind of collaborative orientation. As I moved into a PhD, so what's interlanguage? The proposal was, what if underlying the language that second language learners produce, there is a systematic grammar? So this is coming out of linguistics. It's coming out of a cognitive orientation. Larry was a generative linguist who asked a lot of problematic questions about being that. But he said, what if learner language is not just a collection of errors? It's not just that people are just randomly making errors. Let's assume it's systematic. Let's assume that it is, in fact, as one of his students contributed, does it obey language universals, Larry? Huh. Yeah, I bet it might. Right? So, okay, let's hypothesize that it obeys all the universe. It's a language. It's a natural language. And so if so, then it should have a certain shape and a certain pattern, and we should be able to study it. Right? What is the grammar? What is it? That's where the field began in those days. When I became a doctoral student, though, I became obsessed. Every time people said, the rules of this grammar are systematic, I would say, yeah, but, you know, as a teacher, I know that I did drills in using the audiolingual method with students learning Spanish, and I know that they got this rule. They got it right every single time in the lab. And when they walked out the door into the hallway, they used an entirely different version of that rule, right? So how is interlanguage systematic? And, of course, having studied sociolinguistics, I thought, well, this is like style shifting, right? This is like what African-American people do with their dialect. They do it this way with this context and this way another. So that's what I brought. And as a result, then, after being out for a little bit in my first job, I wrote this paper, Interlanguage as Chameleon. So basically, I've summarized on this slide, Larry's coming out of a cognitive and generative frame of reference. His idea was, okay, interlanguage is what we call the linguistically systematic grammar that underlies learner performance. It's a natural language, obeys language universals, and it's moving close, it's moving. He used to draw things that say start with the native language, and then it moves to the target language. And after lots of discussion, we got him to make the arrow veer off sometimes, because sometimes it doesn't go to the target language. Maybe the learner has another idea of what it ought to be. But anyway, it's in movement. Interlanguage as Chameleon, this came out of many arguments with Larry. But as a natural language, this paper says, interlanguage, all natural languages are variable. All speakers of natural languages shift the way they speak when they move from one situation to another. They pay attention to language form in some situations, and they don't in others. Even young children know that they can use certain words with their friends, but not their grandmother, right? So, I mean, it's a very basic idea that certain language forms are appropriate for talking to you, but not to you, right? So learner language must be like that, right? Both of these were propositions. Both of them were ideas in search of research, right? We hadn't done any research when we said these things. We were saying, what must it be? So we need studies, need research, because lots of people reacted to interlanguages coming in. Lots of people, especially generative linguists, said, no, that can't be right. You know, how can we have variable rules, right? The mind doesn't just play dice. You don't just flip a coin in your mind and say, now I'm going to use this percent or that percent. So generative linguists had a lot of trouble with this idea of a variable competence, I would call it. Maybe the way I said it wasn't very good, but anyway, they didn't like it. In the next decade, the 1980s, a lot of research was done, and there were two competing strands. This is my view of it, okay? I think there was core research, and it was focused on testing the interlanguage hypothesis as it was framed as a cognitive model of grammar. So grammar in the abstract, no talk of context, no talk of style, just what is the rule? Tracking sequences of acquisition, initially of morphemes, because first language acquisition had done that, then negation, questions, and so on. And following a Chomskyan model, the goal was to document systematic patterns of change. How does learner language in the abstract develop? And so on. Not so core researchers like me were busily gathering evidence that these rules were in fact variable, right? That if you changed a task, you got different sequences. You got different accuracy. So task itself, and that's really important for language assessment people who like to give tasks to people to see what the grammar is. So this was a problematic finding that if you change the task, you change the results, right? And we don't want to hear that in large-scale testing, right? So the work of this group was sidelined in part because it was difficult to deal with, right, given the circumstances. People like Leslie Beebe did wonderful work, Miriam Eisenstein. And actually, thinking back on it in the second half of the 80s, this body of people were increasingly published. I mean, we were forming a small group of people who really were interested in social context. So I became editor of Applied Linguistics 84 to 89. And then when people would submit abstracts, and we were three co-editors, Henry Widdowson and Bernard Spolsky and I were co-editors of Applied Linguistics, and we shared, certainly Bernard, all of us really shared an interest in context. So when people submitted papers that took a more socially, contextually friendly approach, we published them, right? We also published the other ones. We published on both strands, right, in Applied Linguistics. Because people were saying, where's the evidence in 1988? And there's on your handout in the back, I have references to most of these papers that I'm citing if you want to look it up. But I published a book that said, here's all the evidence we have so far showing that learner language does shift with task, with interlocutor, with topic. And so there was a body of evidence that we could then cite. And Miriam Eisenstein edited two books like that with edited papers called variation in interlanguage. So things look good by the end of the 80s. But then something happened. Oh, and also one last thing was Selinker and Douglas in 1985. The thing about Larry is he listens, right? So Larry Selinker we'd been arguing about social context. So every time I'd walk in, Larry'd go, yeah, social context. So to see Elaine to say, yeah, social content. So, but he was also doing work with international TAs, and he himself noticed that he had TAs who, when they lectured on their field of study, produced impressive English, you know, wonderful vocabulary, complex syntax, their accuracy was great. But then when you turned around and asked them about a recipe their mother had sent them for cooking, it went. It, hit the grammar disappeared. I mean, it became haltings, short sentences. We would say now complexity, accuracy, fluency went down. So what is this person's inner language? What does this person know? Yeah, if inner language is knowledge, something's shifting here. So he wrote this paper with Dan Douglas saying, Wrestling with Context in Interlanguage Theory, and it's sort of his struggles with the theory and then these people that he was running into. In the 1990s, and really it started in 89, some cognitive and generative SLA researchers started being very vocal and started publishing direct attacks on research that was not generative in second language acquisition. The basic feeling on their part was, this field is too disorganized theoretically. People aren't following our model, right? And there should be only one. If we're going to have a field, we need one theory, right? So what's the Uber theory? A man named Kevin Gregg, published a series of papers. First he wrote one attacking Steve Krashen and the monitor model. And since everybody was attacking Steve Krashen and the monitor model at that time, everyone said, oh, that's a clever little piece. But then he wrote another one attacking John Schumann and the pigeonization hypothesis. And John Schumann said, who is this guy? Right? He's like a food critic who can't cook. Like, he doesn't do research himself, but he's attacking my research, right? Then he wrote a paper attacking the variationist model, and me in particular, right? So it was personal with him. It wasn't just the theory, it was the person, right? So that was icky, actually. I had people say, can people in your field write like this, right? So it was snarky writing. In 1993, Beretta and Gregg, actually, and this is now 4 years after I stopped being the editor, Kevin Gregg and Alan Beretta and a few other people, Mike Long, collaborated on a special issue of Applied Linguistics, and every paper in that issue called for the elimination of social theories of second language acquisition. They said, Kevin Gregg's title was, Let a Couple of Flowers Bloom. You know the thing, let a thousand flowers bloom, the Chinese thing, like let all the ideas flourish and then the best ones will survive. And he's like, no. One, mine, okay, so generative, maybe cognitive, no, that's it. In 1997, Mike Long, I love this paper, he argued that context only affects second language performance. So he pointed out rightly that all of these studies that had been published in the 80s were not longitudinal. None of them were longitudinal. They're all about one single point in time. So you do it this way, and then the next. So he said, how does this have to do with acquisition? Acquisition is about change over time. So what you've only shown is people shift in the moment, but what's the impact on what they acquire, which is a valid point. I mean, that's a valid point. So he said, here's what we need is evidence that these shifts affect acquisition over time, right? Remember that. Remember that. That's very useful. The other thing I loved was he had in the Hawaii paper that I cite, it's not widely quoted, but I love it. He said, you know, the process of second language acquisition is an internal cognitive process. It's internal to the human body. And like all other internal processes, it is impervious to social context. It happens everywhere, regardless of social context. Processes like digestion, sexual arousal, I'm like, really? Those are both internal processes that I would argue are rather sensitive to social context. Bad example, Mike. Anyway, I had fun with that. He also said, and I've already made this point, yeah. So what is evolving here is that different journals started publishing only things from these different strands. So studies in second language acquisition tended to be the go-to journal for the generative and cognitive studies. And then applied linguistics, a little bit language learning, but especially modern language journal, started to publish the papers that kind of argued against this position that there should be just a cognitive approach to second language acquisition. And in the late 90s, counterattack began as people started to publish elsewhere, and where they published was Applied Linguistics, a Modern Language Journal, and in books. So in 1995, just as Mike was saying we need longitudinal data, I had this brilliant doctoral student come study with me in Minnesota. He had done a longitudinal research study in Australia, and he had tracked a six-year-old boy over 2.5 years and looked at his acquisition of a lot of things, but one of them was the stages of questions. And Mike Long had said, show me the stages, the universal sequences of any acquisition of any form changes as a result of social context. And Liu had that evidence. I mean, he had it. He didn't know he had it, but he had it. So he just showed when Bob talked to the teacher, his participant, that was the context in which he used new stages of question last. When he was on his stomach on the floor playing and coloring with the researcher, he produced things first. All new stages of questions came in then. And when he was talking to peers, it was somewhere in the middle. So first at home, next the stages, like weeks later, that stage of question would appear when he was arguing with his friends, last with the teacher. So the teacher was always the last to know that Bob was asking higher stages of questions, right? Except the sequence didn't come in order. Right? Two of the stages came in way out of order, or you could say one came in ahead of them. And so there was something about those situations that caused this change in sequence of acquisition. So I ended up co-authoring a paper with Liu, and my part was the theoretical part that said, see, Mike Long? And his was the very careful, meticulous tracking of what happened and why it happened, right? Jim Lantoff wrote a paper about this time in language learning that was a passionate argument for sociocultural theory as a bridge between mind and situation. Firth and Wagner wrote a paper in 1997 in the Modern Language Journal that became a sort of clarion call, the social turn, you know, that we should know that these guys are wrong, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Like, there's a role for social context. And then in 2000, I wrote a paper that went back to Larry Selinker and Douglas 10 years later after they, or actually more than that, 15 years later, saying, now what do we know? Right. So in the 2000s, and I would say up to 2007, and now, there's a building push for multiple perspectives. We need multiple theories. Sally Mag, and I'm putting here on the slide the journals, because I think the journals had a big role to play. If nobody will publish your research, you don't have a very strong position. So if the only journal in the field had been Studies in Second Language Acquisition, then there would have been no evidence published showing that social context has a role to play. So other journals began to take up that slack, and especially I think Modern Language Journal plays a particularly large role here. I'm on the editorial board, as are a lot of other people, so I'm biased, but you're going to see that it played a big role in the publication of the Douglas Fir paper, which I was asked to talk about. So Sally Magnin was editor from 94 to 2007, and about 3 years after she became editor, she published Firth and Wagner's paper. And then 10 years later, in 2007, her last year, she published a whole issue saying, so what do you think of Firth and Wagner now 10 years later? And she asked everybody from both strands, like, what do you think of this, right? So really pushing the debate, which would not have happened without that journal. In 2007, that was the same year I went to Auckland to a symposium on multiple perspectives in SLA. I believe you were there. It was a great conference. It was very interesting. And out of it came a book, at least one book, by Robert Batstone, which is in your references. In 2007, that same year, Mackie and Gass, who are more generative, more cognitive in their orientation, had a symposium on multiple SLA perspectives. So some people who were interested in cognitive research were open. So things are beginning to open up again. Van Leer was editor of Modern Language Journal from 2008 to 2012. He became ill, and when he died, Heidi Burns stepped in as editor, and she just resigned. So between Leo Van Leer and Heidi Burns, they, especially Heidi, is a force of nature who just said, all this must change, and I'm going to put all the resources of this journal and funds it can provide to try to do something organized. So the things that got published in MLJ were now in sociocultural theory, contrastive analysis, sociolinguistics, language socialization, language identity, biocultural, that's John Schumann, the social brain, sociocognitive, and so on. As the decade progressed, you started seeing publications in MLJ on emotion, embodiment, right? Neo-materialism, translanguaging. So these are all issues that go way, way beyond this hermetically sealed brain that's acquiring a grammar, right? I mean, that's sort of what this is reacting to. And I do think that the Douglas Fir paper is still a reaction to that 1990s declaration that there will only be one theory and it will be a cognitive one. So now I'm going to talk more directly about the Douglas Fir paper. It's about time. It grew out of a process. In 2009, Dwight Atkinson organized a colloquium at American Association for Applied Linguistics in Denver, and he published a book about it in 2011, and he pulled together a group of people to say, okay, you all have these disparate theories. Is there any way that we can sort of synthesize these in any way? I mean, what's the relationship among these different theories? So it, again, is just saying, how are we to go? Are we going to have some kind of way of talking to each other, or are we all just in our little silos doing our little thing? Right. In 2013, Pennsylvania State University, or Happy Valley, we like to call it, got some funding for a two-day meeting, and it was again Dwight Atkinson, but now Jim Lantoff got involved because Jim Lantoff's work in sociocultural theory, he's passionate about it, and it depends on this movement. And then in 2014, there was a meeting at AAAL Portland of a group of people who were invited to come by Heidi Burns, who had money from MLJ to help pay people's transportation, pay for their meals, pay for a couple of nights of hotel, if they would come talk to each other for 2 days and try to see how their work might be related to other people's work in the room. So that is how the Douglas Fir group happened, right? Was Heidi saying, I'm going to invite certain people because I think their work is related. I think if I put them in a room and talked, that this might evolve and be interesting. And it was. It was great. We talked, and the whole idea was, I will publish, she said, I will publish in the Modern Language Journal in the 100th year edition, because MLJ was going to be 100 years old, big hoorah. So as part of that, write a paper together that you can all agree on and see what you can agree on. And what can you come up with? And they pulled out that beautiful, they wanted a visual model, so we had marker pens and we had all kinds of group dynamic stuff going on. It was really fun. And the result was in 2016, the Douglas Fir paper was written. And that wasn't where it stopped, and I'm going to go beyond the Douglas Fir paper because in 2018, that's one year ago, in the AAAL in Chicago, Heidi Burns partnered with Patsy Duff in another meeting saying, who of you who participated in the Douglas Fir group would like to write a follow-up? Like what did we leave out? What needs further emphasis? I mean, what are the implications? And they also invited a number of respondents. So I'm going to talk about both papers now. So this is the Douglas Fir group. This is who the group was. So Jim Lantoff, Meryl Swain, and one of Jim's students, Eduardo Negrarela, and from Florida, a younger person. Everyone said, we're all gray-haired, we need some young people here. So there was an effort to bring in others. Patsy Duff talked about language socialization theory. Bonnie Norton was there to talk about her work on social identity theory. Diane Larson Freeman talked about complexity and dynamic systems theory. Usage-based linguistics, they wanted someone to do that. Lourdes Ortega and then Nick Ellis also, because he works on the mind, right? So trying to say, what does a social mind look like? John Schumann talked about the biocultural perspective, the brain. Literally, the brain is social. That's his thing. And Dwight Atkinson talked about sociocognitive. I talked, as always, about variationist social approaches. Heidi Burns and Meredith Duran both talked about grammar. What kind of grammar are we talking about then if it's not this generative one? Well, systemic functional grammar looks like a good candidate, and they'd already been using it in language teacher education, and it seemed to work. And then conversation analysis, Joan Kelly Hall. Now, you can think of traditions that aren't showing up here. You can think of people who are not showing up here. And if you read the paper, you'll see that it's very explicit about saying we're not claiming to cover everything. We just thought we'd get these people together, and this is what they came up with. And now what do you think? Now it's your turn, right? Now you talk about this stuff. I put the model and the 10 principles on your handout as a way of just distilling what the group came up with. I believe this is Bronfenbrenner's idea that there are these three levels, the micro, the meso, and the macro level, and it seemed to be a good one to use, people argued. So at the micro level, you have the individual learner who's making individual choices about interacting with this one and getting feedback from this one. So it's all the work with case studies and all of that kind of data at the individual level. And then the meso level is when you begin to get genres, maybe with families and communities. Now you get language that's used within that community, this kind of norm that develops that when we talk to grandma, we talk this way, and when we talk to our friends, we talk this way, or when we talk political science, we use this genre, we're going to agree to publish this with these kinds of language norms, and so on. And then at the macro level, there is the country level, the language policy level, and all of those issues that the Douglas Fir paper cites at the very beginning, like, why are we doing this? And the rationale for the whole paper really is saying our world is changing dramatically since 1972, when that paper was written. I mean, in those days, we were looking at second language learners who were, as one person said, the weirdest multilinguals in the world, right? They're Americans, right? They grew up speaking only one language, and then when they got to university, they took a class, right? And then in that class, it's just weird how that works. Like, they learn about grammar, and then they go to Paris, and they can't get from the airport to the hotel. I mean, you know, that was the database. If you think about it, all those years and people gathering data about morphemes and about this and that, it was in the first world, it was usually highly educated adults. It was a very narrow swath of people who were privileged and elite and who were becoming bilingual and so proud, right? Ooh, I can use another language. But ignored are all these people who are now, because of migration, because there's movement now, the ESL teachers that we prepared in the 80s started reporting at the end of the 80s, you know, I've got learners coming to my class, they can't read, right? They can't read, but they're multilingual. They're adding a fifth language, but they can't read. So how do I teach them, professor? I'm like, you know, we hadn't researched those kinds of learners, right? We had no idea. And the whole claim of doing research in SLA was to be able to tell teachers how the human mind acquires second languages. And our teachers knew before the Douglas Fir group said this, a couple decades before, that the world was changing, right? What worked in the 50s and 60s was just clearly inadequate for what was going on. So the Douglas Fir paper starts out saying, look, everything has changed. Plus, there's technology changes. And I know that doesn't show up so clearly in the 10 principles, but there's a very rich discussion about the changing technological world and how it's affecting communication patterns. A lot of discussion in the paper that's very thought-provoking about the border crossing that's happening, the whole idea that you have a nation state within which one language is spoken is like, you know, it's really a different world. So this paper positions itself at the outset of saying, why are we doing this? Because the old way is just inadequate for the reality that we have. What it means to be multilingual now is really, really something that's different, and we have to come to terms with it. Technological changes intersect with those things. You have illiterate adults who are really good with their devices, right? Like, how does this happen, right? So you get these weird mixes of things where you just don't know what's going on, actually. So here are the 10 themes. So, I didn't mention, the paper makes it really clear, in listing the people who are invited, it says the people who are not invited are the ones who think that language acquisition occurs in a module in the brain that's unaffected by anything else. Right? We do not invite those people to this event. Right? Not invited. Right? So language competencies are complex, dynamic, and holistic. That is, they're not Chomsky's linguistic competence. We're not talking about that. Right? Second, language learning is semiotic, so we want to include not just morphemes, but we want collocations, turn-taking, nonverbals. It's about communication, right? So we're trying to situate the study of grammar within communication. Third, language learning is situational, attentionally and socially gated. The variationist person who's been saying this since 1979 goes, yes! Language learning is multimodal, embodied and mediated. Mediated is sociocultural theory. Just how does society mediate the learner? Five, variability and change are at the heart of language learning. Yay! Although here what they mean is individual variability. So here they're saying it's really hard to categorize learners by type now, right? Because you've got a lot of individual variation, and it's almost as if you have to be going back to case studies to try to understand how these forces come together. Sixth, literacy and instruction mediate language learning. Martha Bigelow and I wrote a paper, actually for TESOL Quarterly, as we were working with Somali teenagers who were not literate but very orally proficient in English. And what we said was, hey, how come SLA researchers haven't studied this population? I think the title of our paper is, you know, Doesn't Who We Study Determine What We Know? Right? So here we are trying to come up with universals of second language acquisition based on just this narrow set of learners. And there are thousands, millions of learners who are adults, who are becoming multilingual, who are not literate, and are succeeding in their effort. As far as we know nothing about these learners. So our study of Somali learners in the Twin Cities was the first study I know of that where people had said, let's just take a standard SLA study and replicate it with this new population. That was our initial idea. And we tried to choose a study that could be done with people who weren't reading, right? So that you had to have tasks where it was all oral. And we just replicated it to see, do they do the same things? I mean, it's just a basic replication study. But it turned out nobody had looked at these learners before. And it also became really clear that we were in way over our heads, right? So, I mean, there's just a whole lot going on with that population, which is very hard to study. And there are ethical issues of studying them, which has held back some of our colleagues. But I just think we can't claim to say anything at all about second language acquisition unless we include all kinds of learners in our database. We have to do that. Otherwise, we can't claim to know how the human mind does anything with two languages, right? So, seven, language learning is identity work. That's originally from Bonnie, but I increasingly am seeing how learners take on, shape shift. They take on, part of learning the language is learning how to act like, be another person who uses that language. It's a package. It isn't just a grammar, right? Agency and transfer. Okay, so number eight is really important. The agency is important. Learners aren't just subjected to outside forces. And you can see how if you took a social approach, you might say, well, context determines everything. So it's really important to have number eight, that learners have agency. They have choice. They're not at the mercy of external social forces. They don't just automatically switch because they're talking to somebody who talks another way. They just automatically talk like that. There's choice involved, right? And then ideology permeates all levels. What's happening at the national level, what affects everything, right? So we can't separate our work at the micro level from all the other things. It's a system. As Diane Larson Freeman loves to say, everything interacts with everything else. And finally, emotion and affect matter at all levels. Lots of interest in emotion and the whole. And I know people used to study motivation with multiple choice questionnaires. But, I mean, this is about something much larger than that. It's tied to identity. It's tied to who am I and how much do I care about the language and the culture. So these are the themes that kept coming up over and over again as we sat in that room. And somebody took really good notes and wrote them down. And these are the themes that just kept coming back. So this is really empirical, I think, based on the discussion and people, and also the level of energy and emotion generated in the room when people said these things, the number of people said, yes, right? Versus somebody would mention something and say, yeah, right. So these are the big themes. Follow-up paper, and I see it's two, and I thought I'd be done by now, but let me just say something about the follow-up paper. I brought it. This is a Modern Language Journal published in January of 2019. A year ago, at AAAL, which meets about this time every year, people who had been in this room and others. So the first thing that happened, there was lots of reaction to this paper when it first came out. And a number of people said, why weren't we invited? That was one of the biggest ones. Like, why you? Why not me? Right? Why were you there and not me? Which is a valid question. But what was interesting was it came from cognitive and generative people, right? It was like, Sue Gass says, why wasn't I invited? It's like, well, honey, you know. You know, but she wanted to be there, and she had done the multiple perspectives thing, so she had a valid point, right? So, I mean, a lot of people were not totally close to this, but they weren't invited. And then the next question was, well, so what should some next steps be? So this next paper invited people who were not in the room, and I don't know how they were chosen, because Heidi Burns and Patsy Duff organized this. They invited people. Some agreed to come, and some could not. We had to write papers really fast. So starting a year ago, we had to have papers done in 3 months and ready to be sent out to a group of other people who were going to do commentaries. So some people, John Schumann was there, but he couldn't write a paper that fast, so his paper is not in this. So, I mean, it was a very tight constraint. It ends up being position papers by these people in the third bullet down, Duff, Ortega, Nick Ellis, Larson Freeman, and Kelly Hall. So these are really position papers. The first one is Language Socialization, where Patsy Duff said, what does socialization theory look like when we have truly multilingual settings? Ortega talked about social justice, this whole social justice issue of working with multilinguals and the importance of including them. Nick Ellis writes a paper saying, cognition is what I'm interested in, but cognition is embodied, he has E words, embodied, embedded, enacted, and socially distributed. So he's trying to say I have a model of cognition that is social, right? So he's trying to work it from that angle. Let's see who's next.
Diane
Larson Freeman. She talked about agency in dynamic systems theory. She always talks about dynamic systems theory, but she was saying, I want to talk about agency because we didn't deal with that enough in the DFG paper. So she felt it had been ignored. And then Joan talked about integrating conversation analysis and usage-based linguistics. So she's trying to integrate. She's trying to do the integration thing. I was in that paper because my graduate student, Darren Lescott, actually I had great graduate students the last year I taught, and they did, two of them did wonderful case studies, and Darren's was one of them. And so based on that paper, we co-authored this paper with a little follow-up. The basic idea was he discovered that he took two French immersion teachers to the pub. He had to do a case study for my course. So he took two French immersion teachers to a tavern and bought them frothy drinks. And he turned on the tape recorder and said, talk, just talk in English. It's your second language. So they did. And he caught them telling stories. They told stories about the parents. You know, how do you deal with so-and-so's parent? It's teacher room talk, right? But it's over a frothy drink, and it's in English. And what he caught them doing was constructed dialogue, which is a form of discourse where I'm telling a story, and then I enact. So then he's all blah, 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 and she's all blah, 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 right? You know, so it's like you aren't just reporting speech. You're identifying with, to go to identity, you become, in some way, the character, and you speak the way you create their dialogue. It is not an accurate report. It's my construction of my, including my opinion, of what you said and how you said it. But he caught them doing that. Then he took, did a CAF analysis of their English when they were being their own narrator, and then when they were enacting the American mom. And guess what? He discovered, wait, they sound more American, they're more accurate, they're more complex, and they're more fluent when they're enacting the American mom, right? And then he said, so what do they know? And why don't they talk like that all the time, right? Because they're actually more accurate. But if they were given a proficiency test, they wouldn't show you that they could do that, right? So, I mean, it raised all kinds of interesting questions for teachers and for assessors that, in fact, what you know can be performed like that, right? So anyway, we talked about that, and in the process, we discovered, I mean, we were the only data in this whole chat, in this whole thing, right? Ours is the only data. So we felt, okay, we need some data. And we also talked about the 10 principles, like which of the 10 principles did our study resonate with, and how did it resonate? So that was a lot of fun, actually. Then the commentaries. Atkinson, I'm just going to say Atkinson, and he says, nice try. It's not really integrated. Like the DFG paper and this are still people talking about their own approaches, mostly. So how is this going to, or and then he says, maybe in the modern age, that's a hopeless goal. Maybe we just need to live with this, that people use these different approaches and they can talk to each other some, right? That's Atkinson. Stephen May says, admirable goals. You need to realize that you're up against a big, big problem. The field is pretty set, right? You're not going to change the field. He's pretty pessimistic. He's saying, intractable was a word he used several times. The intractability of monolingual, elitist, disciplinary bias in SLA. Steve May saying, you're not going to change anything. Like, okay. Senos and Gorter, they talk about, sort of like May, the importance of looking at multilingual repertoires. They talk about translanguaging, They're more optimistic. They do ask questions about assessment. What does this all mean for assessment? They're worried. Holt says, you had good theories. You forgot nexus analysis focused on social action. So he adds another theory in, right? Flores and Rosa talk about raciolinguistics. You forgot race, right? How does race factor into all of this? Because it does, and I agree, it does. I started looking at race, after all, so it does. And then Slabakova, this is my favorite, she gives a passionate defense of generative SLA in response to this. Just like, you guys are ignoring generative SLA. If you're going to look at language, you got to look at it this way. And she just talks about without, anyway, it was interesting. It's interesting. Okay. And then Gao and Johnson both talk about implications for language teacher education, because the DFG paper says that this work is important for language teacher education, but they also say we don't have space to really deal with it in an adequate way. And so these two commentators, Gao and Karen Johnson at Penn State, explore those. They both like the model. They think it's useful potentially for working with teachers, and they talk about why. So that's all I have to say. That's a lot. I'm sorry.
Thanks.
Do you have, you want to start off with a response, Gary?
Can well, first you? Of all, thank you, Elaine.
Yes. Oh, okay.